Voilà, so thank you, Doug.
So there it is. So that's what tomorrow's about. Tomorrow is really just focusing on our own practice and finding that balance, finding, again, as we're starting out here, finding a comfortable balance. It's not pedal to the metal. It's not pushing how hard you can do, but really finding, you know, that streaming of just feeling, okay, for 8 weeks, I'm a contemplative. That's my job. That's what I do. And then just finding that flow where you feel relaxed, you feel balanced, you're happy to be engaging in practice. It's not so slack. It's always a matter of balance. It's not so slack that you're just kind of hanging out. And it's not so tight that you're feeling kind of under the gun, you know, discipline, pushing, something in between. So the theme of balance from your neighborhood balance, Walla, you all know the acronym of Bialan and Wallace. The theme of balance is going to be coming through all the time, as it always does. And so this is equally true then for every phase of shamatha practice, every phase. And so just as a reminder, I know a lot of you are familiar with the kind of the approach that I've been emphasizing. Nothing of it essentially in terms of any of the main points, none of it is mine. So people often speak of my approach or my teachings. Well, okay, but as in they're coming out of my mouth. So this is my air coming out of my mouth. But you know, I hope you know that the core teachings, I mean, I keep on citing the sources, so you know it's not just something I've made up. If I made it up, I wouldn't be interested. So there'd be no reason you should be. And so here we are, we're following the teachings of Asanga now, in his extraordinary presentation, which I translated long ago from the Sanskrit and Tibetan, within the Shravakabhumi, one of his great classics of Indian Mahayana Buddhism, and a section in that text on the mindfulness of breathing. And he goes through 16 phases, just like in the Pali Canon. And other great commentaries in the Theravada, he does it, but with a different kind of a different twist, a different emphasis, nuance. And one of the salient points of difference between this marvelous text, which I have very deep respect and reverence, and that is the Buddhaghosa's Visuddhimagga. One difference between Visuddhimagga of Buddhaghosa, great Theravada classic, and this Mahayana classic of Asanga, is when it comes to the third of the 16 phases, mindfulness of breathing, the first four being shamatha, the last 12 being vipassana. The teachings of the Buddha are attending to the whole breath one breathes in, attending to the whole breath one breathes out. Really simple, really, really simple and open to interpretation. So you may recall, some of this just a reminder, that Buddhaghosa, when he speaks of this, when he comments on this, drawing from an old tradition, I'm sure he didn't make this up, his interpretation, is that you're attending to the whole, when he says the whole body, attending to the whole body you breathe in, breathe out. He interprets this as the whole body of the breath, that you're there like a child on a swing. You're in the swing all the way up, then all the way up. So there, you don't fall off and then jump on. You're all the way, the whole body of the swing, the whole body of the breath, the whole course of inhalation, exhalation. It's a very good interpretation. But then on the other hand, Asanga's interpretation is different. He takes it very literally, that you are in fact attending to the entire field and the sensations associated with the breath, the movements of prana, throughout the entire field of the body. Both, I think, are really wonderful interpretations. And I'm actually, just a little bit more commentary on this. In the Theravada then, of course, the sensations there at the apertures of the nostrils, which is, you know, the target area, that's simply called the preliminary sign. And then when you really get into the flow, then eventually, sooner or later, spontaneously, a mental image will come up, the acquired sign. I'm not going to give the whole teaching on that now, but it's a mental image. And you shift, you kind of decouple your attention from the tactile sensations, which are the preliminary sign, just to get going. And then you really focus on the acquired sign, this mental image that is kind of symbolically or mysteriously associated with the air element and breathing. You focus on that until finally you achieve shamatha, and then a much, much, much subtler sign, the counterpart sign, which according to Buddhaghosa is 108,000 times more subtle than the acquired sign, because it's coming from another dimension of reality. It's coming from the form realm, the rupa dhatu, rather than the desire realm where we live. So I recently heard of my good friend Andre Capellari in Phuket. He's Italian, of course, but he's living in Phuket as the resident meditation teacher at the Tanyapura Mind Center. He alerted to me to one really quite senior, I think 85 or so, year old Thai monk, who by all accounts, it seems quite obvious, really deep samadhi. Looks like I've grown skeptical over the years of hearing so many false accounts of samadhi and people achieving jhana, and then under analysis it falls apart. But this one sounded real. It sounded real. And he followed, and I asked Andrea, who's received teachings from him, what was his path? Here's one who really took it through and achieved jhana. Really. I'm very skeptical of most of the accounts. I'm sorry to say, I'd love to believe all of them if they would stand up to analysis. Hardly any of them do, of the reports coming out nowadays. Some do, not many. But this one, Andrea, is very savvy, a good scholar, good experienced meditator. And if this monk's path was there, it's classic Theravada. Mindfulness of breathing, preliminary sign, acquired sign, counterpart sign. It's a real deal. So there's one authentic path. And it takes you from the realm of the senses into the realm of the mind and then onto the form realm. You know? So it makes it very transparent. It's transparent. It's really quite compelling. With a sangha, you are attending to tactile sensations. And so I won't elaborate now. If you have a question about it, I can answer it later. But I've become quite persuaded that even though he never makes any allusion to the acquired sign or counterpart sign, it's tactile sensations, but subtler and subtler and subtler tactile sensations. I give my interpretation, because he just makes no reference to these acquired and counterpart signs. And I've never seen that anywhere in Indo-Tibetan Buddhism. It's a Theravada deal. And the Buddha never taught it. That doesn't mean it's incompatible with the teachings of Buddha, but he never referred to acquired sign, counterpart sign. So I am totally persuaded they exist. So many things that are true the Buddha never talked about, as he himself acknowledged. You know, what his recorded teachings, one leaf in the forest, and what he was aware of, all the rest of the leaves in the forest on an autumn day. You know? But a sangha, he teaches this so simply in a way. It's elegant, it's subtle. But you're focusing just on the tactile sensations of the flow of respiration, the flow of prana throughout the entire body. And as your whole cycle of breathing calms and calms and calms, it gets subtler and subtler. My interpretation may be wrong, because it's me now. Not just me talking. So sometimes I'm speaking with like 1,500 years of gravitas behind my words. And then sometimes it's teeny, teeny to me. So this is just me. But my sense of it is that he's taking you to these extremely subtle levels when you've gone a long way on the path of shamatha. And he takes you right up to the cusp, there on the ninth stage, incredibly subtle sensations of the movements of prana in the body. And then you disengage, you decouple from them, and you slip right into the substrate consciousness. Slip right into the form realm. That's my sense of it. He takes the desire realm as subtle as it can go until you're right next door, and then release. I think very elegant. But now, I mentioned the theme of balance, because I'm going to keep on mentioning it. The balance wall has to say it probably every day, so I do. The first one, the first balance, and that's for all of us here, even though some of us here have been meditating for quite some time, just coming back to the basics, coming back to the ground, coming back to the ground relaxation. The most relaxed being in the universe is a Buddha. So there are only six perfections, but there could be seven. The perfection of relaxation. And I'm actually not kidding. Because even at a 10th stage Arya Bodhisattva, you have to give a little bit of effort. A little bit of effort to your meditation and to serving sentient beings. And then you cross that threshold from a 10th stage Arya Bodhisattva to perfect awakening. Then effort's finished. Betsu meva, no effort. Hrungidupa, spontaneously actualized. Yeah. So the Buddha's activity is boundless, and yet the effort is zero. All spontaneously actualized, just poof, like that. That's the perfection of relaxation. I'm not going to try to persuade them, at seventh. But there it is, it really is true. And that's the trajectory, if you look at the nine stages of shamatha. It's a kind of little microcosm of the faint facsimile of the path to enlightenment. That's all it is. But it's a little faint facsimile that you're going from maximum degree of effort required at the beginning. And then as you progress along the path, it gets less and less and less effort until you get to the ninth stage, just before shamatha, and then your shamatha practice is effortless. Eighth stage, a little bit of effort to get in, and then it's smooth. Ninth stage, in effort, less, out effortless. So tiny facsimile, some faint resemblance to what is immeasurably further along the path. So I'm emphasizing this because, especially we living in the modern world, we tend to emphasize it too little. Right? And so the balance in this first phase that we're about to begin is relax like you've never relaxed before. Don't think you've just gotten relaxed enough and then be content with that. Don't be content, not until you're Buddha. Still more progress. More relaxed, more loose. The ramifications are everywhere. If somebody says something to you, rubs you the wrong way, are you relaxed or are you going, oh? Oh? You talking to me? You talking to me? Who do you think you're talking to? Hey, you're talking to me, don't you know I am? I'm Dr. Wallace. Oh, Dr. Wallace, don't say Mr. Wallace, Dr. Wallace. Mm. You know, you lost your relaxation. It's called uptight. Oh. So just whatever's there, you know. You're just loose and relaxed. Some of you have the great good fortune to know some Tibetan yogis, lamas and so forth, really mature in practice. That's a big sign, you see it everywhere. They're so mellow, so relaxed, so no ego. You know, they can be tough. That's not ego. That's tough compassion. There's a role for that. You know? So there it is. So there's, but that's not balanced. Be as relaxed as you possibly can. That's not balanced. That's just being relaxed as you possibly can. So where's the balance come in? Where's the balance come in, Claudia? What's the balance? What do you balance? You're getting more and more relaxed. Where's the balance factor? Okay. You're gonna remember it next time, huh? Hosa. Brazil's on the spot. So far, Brazil zero. I'm Germany. I'm winning. Amy?
Don't lose the clarity.
Don't lose the clarity, yeah. Remember? Yeah. Relax, sure. But if all you're doing is relaxing, you're just taking a nap. You're going to sleep. That's good. But it's not shamat. It's not balanced. It's not armor practice. It's called taking a nap. So this is it. Now you're going to remember. And you too, huh? Yeah, that's why I pick on you. Then you'll remember for sure. I might even ask you a second time. Look out. So there it is. That's it in a nutshell. And it's something not really that point. If you listen to a lot of really wonderful lamas, they probably won't come up with that. What's the first, if you ask some lama, what's the first step of balance in shamatha? They probably won't say, relax really deeply, but don't lose clarity. But if you listen to them, you'll see, well, you actually have to be relaxed. And of course, don't lose clarity. But for the likes of us, you know, living in modernity, where one good friend of mine who's got a solid, he's an old buddy of mine, we've known each other since 1973. Old friend, Losantarpke, his name is, happy to say his name, knows Dharma very well, thoroughly trained in Tibetan medicine, and degree in psychology. He's a psychological researcher at UCLA. He made the comment, oh, you Americans, he was talking in Washington, D.C., but it doesn't let you Australians off the hook, or you Brazilians, same problem. You Westerners, you modernists, you know, he said, you all have nervous disorders. You're all lung disorders. All of you, considering how ill you are, you're coping very well. But you know, I really think it's literally true. In comparison to, you know, imagine your life as being out on that high nomadic plains at 5,000 meters and you've been living there for the last 40 years. Do you think your nervous system's going to be what it is here, now? Not very likely. And so then we really need to attend to that. We need to take into account what is specific to our time and place. Factor that out. Not writing us off, we're not irreversibly damaged, we're just damaged. But not irreversibly damaged, that's the really good news. And so that's why big emphasis. And I know it's well, because, you know, I think I just spoke with somebody who knew me from years ago, a little tiny bit, one uptight monk. Oh, really true. I was kind of intense back then, unlike now that I'm just so mean. Intense and uptight, I think so. I kind of know so, yeah. Yeah. It comes with sincerity, but it also comes up just having ego and being pushy all the time. So there it is. So there's a balance. I'm going to stop talking quickly, go back to the meditation. But there it is. Hold it in mind, it's worthwhile. It will save you some time. You remember the Dalai Lama's comment, is it necessary to have a guru to achieve enlightenment? No, but it can save you a lot of time. That's my only job here. Not even to, I want to be your guru. Guru, not guru, your choice. But I am here as your spiritual friend to try to save you some time.
That's
valuable. So, emphasis here, and for some time now, really relaxing more and more deeply, letting go. Every out-breath is a really good time to expire, to exhale, to release. But maintaining clarity. Don't lose the clarity with which you began. There's one point, only one more point, and then we go in. I mentioned in passing, but I'm going to emphasize a bit more, that when you bring your awareness into the body, down into the torso, down into the limbs, down right down to the ground, where your buttocks are in contact with the chair or the floor or what have you, or your supine position, when you're bringing your awareness, really it's kind of a descent into this field, somatic field, because we have six fields of experience, right? This is one of them. You're bringing your awareness into and focusing the intention on the field of the body and the sensations arising in that field, right? Well, that field is a non-conceptual field. There are no thoughts in that somatic field. There's no chit-chat. There's no conversation. There's no words. These sensations of earth, water, fire, and air, they don't talk in any language. You've seen them. They are what they are, but it's not talk. So you're going into a non-conceptual domain. That's kind of the point. And moreover, when we're doing this phase, what I'm just going to call phase one of this particular kind of sequential approach to mindfulness of breathing, when you're going here, you're kind of just immersing your awareness in a field of experience that is non-conceptual. And what you're attending to are non-conceptual sensations. So I mentioned earlier in that kind of Dzogchen approach, coming back to Simona, you're attending to the sensations of the breath kind of out of the corner of your eye, so to speak. But now, in this practice, if Simone's the space of my body and the sensations, you're giving it full attention. You're really saying, okay, I'm with you. You are now the center of my attention. I am attending to the space of the body. I am attending to the sensations throughout, and I'm especially attending throughout the entire field to those sensations correlated with the in and out breath. So that's your full attention. And then a little bit you're monitoring with introspection, and then in the background there is awareness of awareness. But you're really grounding there. Going there and to this somatic field, to this non-conceptual field. And I'll give you an analogy that works for me. And that is, if you want to make a vacuum, so have like a glass jar or a vial, a glass jar, and you'd like it to make a vacuum, so it's a vacuum jar. There's just nothing in it. All the air's gone, right? Well, there's one way to do it. There's many ways of doing it, but here's a very simple way, transparent intellectually, and that's all I need right now. Fill it full of water. Fill it full of water, put a cap on it with a hole in it, and then suck all the water out. And don't let anything get back in. All right. But fill it full of water first. Right. And then you have an empty vial, an empty pot. And so that's kind of what we're doing here with the space of the mind. And that is, we're bringing the space of the mind, the space of our mental awareness, we're bringing that right into the space of the body, and we're filling the space of our awareness with the somatic field, which is non-conceptual. We're filling it with the somatic field. So your awareness is permeating just the space of the body, and as hopefully, as little as possible, is it trickling out into the space of the mind, which is going blah, blah, blah. You know, you're filling the space of your awareness with the water of your somatic field and the sensations of the breath within that field. And the field and the somatic sensations, tactile sensations of the respiration, are both non-conceptual. So you're filling the space of the mind with a non-conceptual space and non-conceptual appearances. Fill it. You know. And so then you're like, whoa. I mean, there's just no role for talking here. There's nothing to say. It's filled. And then, when you get more used to that, and then eventually, when the time is ripe, we're going to be going over to settling the mind in its natural state. And we'll be attending to the space of the mind, which is filled with all kinds of chit-chat. Right? That's what it does. But we'll be approaching it from the perspective of awareness that's empty. We'll try to bring a vacuum of awareness, attending to the very full space of the mind with all its thoughts and so forth, but bringing to it an awareness that is quiet, that's all the concepts have been sucked out. So we need to get comfortable with this. Comfortable that it's not threatening, it's not frightening, it doesn't give us a sense of anxiety, to be in an empty space devoid of thought And yet, crucial point, the last point I'm going to make, empty space, devoid of thought, but not devoid of cognizance, not devoid of knowing, not spacing out, not just going blank mind. That doesn't take you anywhere at all, except for stupor to stupid. That's all that does. And so we're doing something here that, again, we never learned in school and is not part of the mainstream at all, but maintaining a flow of non-conceptual cognizance. That's just not part of any education I've ever heard of in the West, because all of our cognizance and knowing is totally embedded in a conceptual framework, which is useful, but limited. And here, as we go into contemplative inquiry, into shamatha, vipassana, into mahamudra, then the ability to sustain the flow of knowing without it being enmeshed in a conceptual framework, conceptual elaborations, is absolutely essential. It's called drupa mepa, tutel, free of conceptual elaboration, free of conceptual elaboration, right? But maintaining the flow of knowing. So this is really crucial. I'm not kind of wasting any words here. But we need to get used to that. You don't start when you practice vipassana, you start with mahamudra. You better have your momentum up, because this is an ability, is an absolutely crucial. We're going here to the realization of Rigpa, which is the very nature of knowing that transcends all conceptual frameworks. So you better not start then. Don't think you can start then. You know, start way back here, at the ground level of shamatha, and learn through practice how to sustain a flow of cognizance that's not bound up in chit-chat. And one way of doing it is sustain that flow of cognizance, the flow of awareness, the flow of knowing, within a non-conceptual field, attending to non-conceptual appearances, and attend to them non-conceptually. Okay? So this is all quite important. Quite important. Save you a lot of time. But also, each of these stages is designed to prepare you for the next. So we'll have time this afternoon to go a little bit into some of the basic preliminary practices. The more these are just suffusing and transforming your way of viewing reality, these preliminary practices, each one, there's only six, three common, three uncommon. Each one is a revolution. I'm not using that word lightly. Each one is a revolution. Each one, if you absorb it, it will shift the way you view reality. Big time. And that shift is necessary, according to all the great masters, all of them who are really accomplished in Mahamudra, Dzogchen, Vajrayana, and so on. And so, but together with that, this ability. So with that, let's go into practice. Now I won't need to give much commentary during the practice. I've front-loaded it, which I like to do. So then if you remember and bear that into the session, then I don't need to talk. We can all meditate without multitasking. It'll be a good sign if after some time when you hear the meditation bell at the very beginning of the session, it triggers a type of Pavlovian response of relaxation, not salivation, but just relaxing. And then the sense of loosening, the shoulders dropping, the face relaxing, the awareness descending. What a relief. You come to a place of simplicity and quiet and clarity. In this mood, Settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural states as you've done before. From that culminating stillness of awareness, relaxed, still, and clear, let the light of your awareness permeate the whole field of the body. Illuminating the sensations throughout the entire field, with a special interest in those sensations correlated with the respiration. When you become familiar with the practice, there's nothing to think about. It is simply maintaining the flow of cognizance and noting without internal chit-chat. When the in-breath is long, you know that it's long. You don't even need to call it long. You know it before you label it. When the out-breath is long, you know that it is long. And breath by breath, as your whole body, mind, system calms down, settles into a more placid state of equilibrium, you'll need less air. The breath may very well become more shallow, and therefore shorter. Continue attending to the sensations related to the breath, and when the in-breath is short, note that it is short. When the out-breath is short, know that it is short. Then why don't we combine the two interpretations of Buddhaghosa and Asanga, attend to the whole body, the sensations of the breath throughout the entire field, without visualizing the field, just being immediately aware of it, but also attend to the whole body of the breath, and that is to say, remain continually engaged, mentally engaged with the sensations of the breath throughout the entire course of in-breath, the entire course of the out-breath. So take this on as a full-time job. No tea breaks, no time for chit-chat, no time for anything else. For the remaining minutes of this session, sustain as much as you can unbroken continuity, a continual engagement of your awareness with the sensations of the entire course of the in and out breath throughout the entire body. Whatever thoughts come up, release. First of all, relax. Then release. And then return. Keep it simple. And let's continue practicing now in silence. So, a very brief reminder of a comment I made earlier, and that is we'll get to the spacious path of freedom quite soon, but I did want to cover a bit of the preliminary practices prior to going right into the main practices there, because you are, after all, skipping something like, I don't know, maybe 200 pages of material, so he really emphasized it a lot. And what I'm intending to do here is not skip that, but give what Dujum Lingpa presents as really the essence of all of that. And he also doesn't say don't do prostrations and so forth. He doesn't say that at all. But when he gets to, in this text that I'm about to give a little bit, transmission of an excerpt, it's called The Foolish Dharma of an Idiot Clothed in Mud and Feathers. He makes no references to doing 100,000 of anything. He doesn't even make any references to doing prostrations or vajrasattva and so forth. Again, not because it's not important, but he's saying what is essential. So some things are important. Many things are important. Not everything is essential. And he's about to say. So when I'm reading this, please understand, this is his view. My view doesn't kind of matter. I'm so, frankly, just to be really honest, my views are so insignificant that it's really not even worth talking about. I'm simply passing on the view of a man who's truly a Vidyadhara. He absolutely knows what he's talking about. I say that with utmost confidence. So this is an excerpt, and he's going right to the point, these three points, three common preliminaries, three uncommon preliminaries, and here we go. Right into the old transmission, I received the transmission, the commentary from Gyatso Rinpoche. So Dujum Lingpa writes, and this is a personal narrative, it's almost a quasi-spiritual autobiography, at the same time as giving utterly quintessential, amazing teachings, introduction to Dzogchen. So he writes, in my opinion, if you don't submit your snout to the hook and rope of self-centeredness, but rather aspire for the hereafter, by thinking of definitely reaping a harvest for all future lives, free of deception. Then if you don't do something meaningful in this present, precious human rebirth, with its leisure and opportunity, it will be difficult to attain such an opportunity repeatedly in the future. I really could spend a day on that one, that one sentence. He doesn't mince words. There's no fat in his teachings. It's just clean all the way through. Every phrase, this is my view, this is just the way I'm reading it. Self-centeredness, what is that? Just a reminder, self-centered is not kind of some people are selfish and some people are not. Self-centeredness is basically a raw, primal impediment to any kind of spiritual practice, and that is putting one's own well-being above that of others. And it happens in Dharma as it happens in, you know, competitive world of capitalism and so on and so on. Of really saying, well, you know, finally, I'm going to look after myself. So I just have to place the priority on that. After all, I experience my feelings. I don't experience Amy's or Suzanne's or Jamatiki. So that's yours, and that's yours, and that's yours. And this is mine, so you take care of yourself. I'll help out if I can. But when all is said and done, you know, I need to take care of myself. That's number one. I look out after number one. That's the way you say it, right? I'm looking out after number one. That's self-centeredness. So, and one can even bring that into spiritual path. And that is, I want to get out of samsara as quickly as possible. All of you, good luck, but I'm going to get out and I'm never coming back. I don't know how you can construe that as not self-centeredness. So tough. But that's, I don't know how you can do that. How are you going to avoid that conclusion? If you're really aspiring to leave samsara and never come back and leave everybody else here, somehow that just strikes me as inadequate. Sorry, that sounds maybe judgmental. Lots of breaks. But he says, if you don't submit your snout, well, that's like a pig or a cow. And then you're just pulled around. So you feel, I'm doing this, I'm doing this, I'm doing this. No, in fact, you're not. You're the cow, and you've given your snout to this mental abnormality, obscuration of self-centeredness. And you feel you're in charge, but in fact you're just being dragged hither and yon by something that is not you at all. You are not your self-centeredness, otherwise you can never be free of it. If you were it, then you can't be free of it, because it's you. So really to have an I-it relationship with self-centeredness is a really good idea. Just having an I-it relationship, and if you heard me speak of this, the Martin Buber theme of I-it, I-you, I-thou, to have an I-it relationship with your mental afflictions is a really good idea. Dehumanize them, the little bastards. You know? I'll speak as hard as you want me to do some real profanity here, probably not necessary, but man, I'll be tough, I'll be harsh, I'll be scornful, I'll be deprecating, of mental afflictions. I try not to do that to sentient beings. And when I do, it's my fault. But boy, I'll be merciless. Shantideva, he was mean. He's one mean dude when it comes to mental afflictions. He's going for total annihilation. Ethnic cleansing of mental afflictions, genocide. Do not leave a single one standing, you know, total annihilation. Then you become an arahat. You've killed all your enemies. Da jomba, roya. You've conquered all your enemies. So really, it's good to have an I-it relationship with mental afflictions, with self-centeredness, with self-grasping. That's really healthy. Just don't have an I-it relationship with any sentient being, including yourself. So he said, if you don't do that, you kind of wake up and say, hey, that's never actually served me well. That just kept me in samsara forever. And so you shift gears. Here's a revolution. In the first sentence, he's giving a revolution. Because this is how most of us, not the bad guys, not the non-Buddhists, this is how most of us are completely habituated. And that is putting our own self-interest first. You know, that's just deeply ingrained. We're born with it. It's innate. So he says, if you wake up to that and don't do that anymore, and then you shift gears and you shift, and now here's the revolution. You're shifting your aspiration from absolutely prioritizing hedonic success, pleasure, acquisition, and so forth and so on of this life, which is top priority for most people. They're not bad, it's just that's the way it is. So here's a revolution. Instead of placing that as the highest priority, my happiness in this lifetime, my success, other people admiring me, respecting me, giving me stuff, having status, having power, oh, I want more, you know, like that. So, well, revolution time. That's in the back seat, and the front seat is attending, well, gosh, if this is true, and man, it's it's a cosmically important hypothesis, that death is not termination. I'm not going to elaborate on it, but boy, death is a termination, death is not termination. These are two different universes to live in. Two different universes. If the first one's right, that's one universe. The materialists. Good. Life is a very short chapter. It's over. Finito. Oblivion. You've just achieved the third noble truth. Cessation of suffering and the cause of suffering just by stop breathing. What an easy way out. I really envy the materialists on occasion. If it just weren't so bloody depressing. So if you've kind of got, you know, come out of that mesh of confusion of just, you know, thinking somehow the mind is the brain, etc. You come out of that, and you have as your working hypothesis, maybe it's deep faith, deep conviction, maybe you actually know what you're talking about, of this continuity of consciousness, that there is consciousness after this brain death, for which we now have, frankly, quite a bit of empirical evidence from science, let alone thousands of years of experience, from Hindus, Buddhists, Taoists, Christians, Sufis, and even Jews. Jews, it's right there in the Kabbalah, mainstream Kabbalah. Continuity of consciousness, life after life after life. So from my perspective, I'm just going to stop right there. The evidence is overwhelming, and the contrary evidence looks like a joke. Just like a joke. I can't even take it seriously more, which makes it hard for me to critique materialism with a straight face, because it just looks, you know, stupid. Sorry, but that is my perspective. So I'm going to finish with that. So you aspire for the hereafter. You're looking to future lives by thinking of definitely reaping a harvest for all future lives. And that is what we're doing now. This is the revolution. What we're doing now with these moments, these days, years, decades of our lives, we can shift everything. In this lifetime, this can be the life that turns it all around. If it's true that we've been wandering around in samsara for countless lifetimes in the past, this could be the lifetime where that never happens again. Not that we'll not be reborn again, but we're not wandering around like blind dogs on a garbage dump. No, this could be the life that turns it all around. This could be the life where we find a path and we're never off the path. From this point on, it's and actually has direction. It's moving towards awakening. It could be this life. This is the one. It could be this one. The teachers are there. The teachings are there. Everybody here is in good enough health. I'm not in perfect health. Who is? But good enough, you know. So this could be the life. We have leisure, we have opportunity, we have teachers, we have the teaching, we have spiritual friends, and we don't have to spend every doggone waking moment just trying to survive, which is true for billions of people on the planet. So I'm sure you don't think that in saying this, this puts us in any kind of superior position, like now we get to look down on the poor. Ugh, vomit bag time. You know, not that. But that's what he's saying here. It's not a time of any, even the smidge, not an iota of a sense, oh, I'm better than other people. It's just like, whew, what an opportunity. That is just, here I am. You know, What an opportunity. What is it Shantideva said? Just like coming across a jewel. You know, what do you say? Like garbage dump or something? Just coming across a jewel. Well, you didn't earn it. Like that. It's not that you're superior, but it's just, wow, look at that. That's a wish-fulfilling jewel. I could do anything with that. And then he says, this precious human life is more valuable than a wish-fulfilling jewel. They can only satisfy hedonic pleasure. I can give you mansions and cars and sex and all that kind of stuff. Cool. But that's all a wish-fulfilling jewel can do. Just hedonic pleasure. What we have right now, this body we have right now, more precious. In fact, it's infinitely more precious. This could be the lifetime. Turn it around. So that's what he's saying. By definitely reaping a harvest for all future lives, free of deception, no self-delusion, no delusion of others, then if that's what your aspiration is, you're not just going to go and be kind of like the servant of self-centeredness anymore. You really have woken up to the fact that there's a continuity of consciousness, and right now we are sowing the seeds of our future. And we can sow really good seeds for reaping a fantastic harvest in all future lifetimes. If you get that, if you really have woken up to that, then he says, if you don't do something meaningful in this present precious human birth with its leisure and its opportunity, everything's come together in this lifetime to turn it around forever. If you recognize that and you still don't take advantage of it, you still don't do something meaningful, you still piss away your time just following one hedonic pleasure after another, one more little thing, one little thing, little thing, and then you're dead. If that's what happens, he says, it will be difficult to obtain such an opportunity repeatedly in the future. If you piss it away once, why do you think you'd get it again? It's a simple logic. You know, if you're a human being, you're living as an animal, why do you think you're going to be a human being again? You're already prepping for animal rebirth. You know, if you're living like a preta, why do you think you'd be a human being? You'd be born as a preta. You know, hell being same. So, but even being a human being, my goodness, I just think human being, I just think aging, sickness, and death. We have 7 billion of us on it. Not a very happy planet right now. Not for many people. We're all seven billion of them are all human. For a lot of people, that's just tough. Tough being human in this planet. And then there's those who are hedonically doing very well. That's nice, I'm very glad. It's years or decades, and it's over, and it's completely over. Means that's terminated. The karma of this lifetime, that's really finished. Don't expect any spillover. The karma that propelled in this lifetime, when it's finished, the fat lady has sung. It's over. Continuity of consciousness, no, but this, to think that any of the kind of the hedonic pleasures we have that's going to carry over, that's a fool's dream. So it'll be difficult. I mean, this is rather a muted statement. It will be difficult to obtain such an opportunity repeatedly in the future. I think you put that into America to be, forget about it. That's why they often say, this life alone. They often say that, this life alone. You know, not that it's ultimately true, not that, you know, forever and ever, ever, you'll never have such an opportunity. You know. But when they say, this life alone, they're kind of emphasizing, in the foreseeable future, don't piss away with this one. That'd be really such a shame. So he concludes, this occasion of circumstances aligning and finding freedom to practice authentic Dharma, finding freedom to actually follow a path that leads out of samsara, and not just to escape from samsara, but to perfect awakening, the non-abiding nirvana that is neither absorbed in nirvana nor absorbed in samsara, encompasses both, path of Mahamudra. This occasion of circumstances aligning and finding freedom is no more than a dream. So if you pointlessly squander it, when you lose the freedom you have right now, what will you do? Really pointed. It's like he's talking right to each of us here in this room, everyone listening by podcast. If you pointlessly squander this opportunity in this lifetime, where you do have freedom, and then, of course, you're going to die. And the freedom you have of this lifetime is going to be finished. It doesn't matter what you were. Whether you're a dog or a gopher or a deva or a hell being in this lifetime, when it's finished, it's totally finished. So if you lose that freedom and you die, what will you do then? That's good. That's... Reflecting on that strikes me as being more valuable than reciting some liturgy 100,000 times with a wandering mind. And I did not just criticize doing the preliminaries. I just criticized doing the preliminaries in a shabby, mindless, mechanical way. And there's not everybody practices that way. Some people practice really, really well. Others, like myself, I didn't do too well. I didn't really find deep transformation in just reciting a bunch of stuff. That's why I don't do a whole lot of ritual now. So he concludes, carefully reflect on this. Carefully reflect on this and know your own situation for yourself. So he's taking it right, he's bringing it right back to us. Just know your own situation. What's your situation? Uniquely. He said, this is the first point. There's two more, and that's it. And then he's finished with the common preliminary. Yeah. So, powerhouse. But you see, there's no ritual here. There's no routine. There's no dogma, frankly. This is either true or false. If it's false, then who cares about it? If you just terminated death, then who cares? You know, relax. Take your piña colada. Go surfing. That's what I would do. You know? Really. I'm not quite sure I would do that, but... I've never been crazy about piña colada or surfing. What can I do? I'm really a loser. Total loser. So I'm sorry, I never had that much appeal. So this is the first point. So that's that. But you see, I mean, he just, in one short paragraph, bam, he dropped a nuclear bomb in our worldview and says, you know. And what, I'm going to just skip ahead a little bit. I'm not going to read the next two points right now. We'll save that for next Monday. But I'm just going to read this last paragraph as he summed up the three. These three points are the field of sublime Dharma, the exhortation to achieve liberation, and the sole guide, guardian, and spiritual mentor to turn you away from the paths that descend into the dungeon of suffering of samsara and the miserable states of existence. These three. The spirit of emergence, often translated as renunciation, and spiritual zeal, that's the enthusiasm, of those who lack these three points, who have not brought about three revolutions in the way of viewing their own existence and the reality as a whole and the nature of mind. People who have not brought that about. They can still practice. They can still practice. They can still, I want to achieve liberation. I want to achieve liberation. Without having really brought about three profound revolutions in the way of your reality. A lot of people want freedom. A lot of people feel enthusiastic. I like Dharma. I like yoga. I like meditation. I like this Lama. I like this Guru. Happens all over the world. But what's he going to say here? The spirit of emergence, or the renunciation and spiritual zeal, the enthusiasm for practice of those who lack these three points, who have not brought about these three true revolutions, are like dew in the summertime. That's pretty clear. Dew in the summertime. We've all seen it. It's there in the morning. Mid-morning, it's gone. So I think that's just true. That's just true. I've seen that happen so many times. Just true. So he's trying to give you some depth here so that your spirit of immersion, sense of renunciation will be enduring, it will carry you through times of felicity, times of adversity, aging, sickness, death, good times, bad times, there. And the enthusiasm will be robust, doesn't collapse on the bad days and so forth and so on. It will not be like dew in the summertime, but something that can endure and carry you on a path from this lifetime, beyond lifetime, reaping a bountiful harvest until you're awakened, fully awakened. So, I just jumped ahead. Many of you can fill in the spaces, but that first one, it runs so profoundly contrary, this whole emphasis, you know, standard lamrim, it's one of the four thoughts that turn the mind. And he's basically collapsing four thoughts to three thoughts. But it says, the Tibetan says, lo do namji, four thoughts that turn the mind. It's a pretty good translation, four thoughts that turn the mind. It's four elements, four themes, lo do namji. It's four themes, the contemplation of which, lo do, turns your mind right around. Turns your mind right around. You know, so we consider, I mean, we're all living here in the 21st century, we know what's going on, we know what common views are. And I would say it's absolutely not a common view to think that being human is something rare and precious. They say, what's so rare? The population's been going through the roof for centuries now. There's plenty of them, there's too many of us. They have 7 billion, it's growing, we're all eating. What's precious human existence? Like, you know, we have a lot of us. Rare? I don't think so. 7 billion and growing, what's so rare about that? And precious, well, you know, it's a tough life. Some people are lucky, some people not lucky. You know, it's genetics, it's brain chemistry, it's luck, it's what family you're born into. I think that's a normal view. Normal view. And the notion of killing time is kind of actually used in a pleasant way. Hey, you want to go out and kill some time? Sounds good to me. What do you want to do? I don't know. Let's just go out and find some way to kill some time. Mm-hmm. What's time, your life? And so I'm going to take a little bit of my life, you know, like just one day or a week. I'm going to put it on the ground. Brain splattered all over the ground. I just killed some time. It was only one day. You want to kill some time next week too? I got some time to spare. I got all the time in the world. You know? So that's common. That's common, you know. Let's just piss away some time. Let's just go off and have a good time. It's very, very common. Very common. It happens among religious people. It happens among non-religious people. You know? So this is a revolution. It is completely turning around. All attitudes to our very existence, our human existence, identity, what this is all about. What is human existence? Is it a short story or is it a never-ending story? Boy, that couldn't be a more different option. It couldn't be more different. You know, you can die any moment and be obliterated, which of course is true, as in this lifetime, or there is never any escape from reality forever. But what could be more different than that? You know? And the first one's so easy. Let's just have a good time. After all, we have only one life to live. That's just repeated so often. It's like, you know, as if it's like the laws of gravity, like something everybody knows. You have only one life to live. Let's just have a good time. You know? Until you're not. And then we'll talk about the battle with cancer. And he lost his battle with cancer. So sad that he got sick. Oh, he died. It was so, like, we're all surprised. He got old. It was the strangest thing. But the years went by, you know. Got old. Go figure. Who saw that coming? He got sick. Oh, he was so well. He got sick. I'm so astonished. He was so healthy, and now he's not healthy. Oh, oh. And this person died. He wasn't even 90. He was only 85. And he died. Oh. Very strange world where we're living. Like, there were a bunch of babies in diapers, not seeing anything coming at all. You know. And then when it comes, oh. Freaking out. You know, freaking out. It's terrible. Terrible. So who saw that coming? Life is not so fun anymore. Give me some drugs quickly. I'm getting depressed. I'm getting anxious. Prozac. Xanax. I can't sleep. Ambien. I can't have sex. Valium. No, not Valium. What's the other one? I haven't taken it. Valium. There's another one. What's that called? You know. Viagra, give me Viagra, yeah, give me some Viagra. Because I want to sleep, have sex, and not be depressed or anxious. Just give me what you got. Just go into the pharmacy. What you got, I want that. Because life isn't working out so well without drug. So give me the drugs to basically stifle all the symptoms of reality. Well, that's common. That's common. So that's a revolution. If it's not true, forget about it. Who cares? Who cares about fairy tales and dogma and stuff like that? But if it's true, oh man, that changes everything. It's a whole new game. Whole new game. It's not even similar to the other game. Not even similar at all. So there's something at punch. Dujum Lingma, he punches. Punches right through. He's not finished. He's got five more. It will change your life. If you follow any one of them, it'll change your life. Change all six, you'll actually be prepared to practice Mahamudra. And if you want to do five sets of 100,000, that's fantastic, great, go for it. Yeah. That's kind of like, you know, living with someone and having a very deeply committed relationship for years and then finally getting married, that's nice. That is having a wedding, that's nice. It's a nice ritual, like, oh, now we've done it. But the commitment has to already be there, otherwise it's an empty ritual, right? So something like that. Oh, yeah. So what I'd like to do, we've just kind of been warming up here. We've had the last couple of days, you know, conversation, getting settled in, seeing what can be fixed, what can't be fixed. I did the same thing for my first 2 days. And we saw pretty clearly, this can be fixed, this can't. Fix the things that could be, and then just relax with things that can't be changed. So everybody, we have a couple of days for that. Tomorrow we have our day of just, you know, focusing on our own practice. What I'd like to do, and we will do, is starting Monday. If anybody's already checked, and people by podcast have checked, it's now the notes, correct, Doug? The notes are up on the website already, or not yet?
They will be tonight.
So I've already put up several pages of notes, including what I just read. That's on the website, right, for, you know, related to this, to the retreat and the podcast. And so, again, I just every day have people in mind, in my heart, in my thoughts, who are listening by podcast. This is all for you as well, and then, of course, explicitly for the people here. What I would like to do starting Monday is have a short time, relatively short, devotional practices, which outwardly look like ritual. And whether it's a meaningful ritual or not meaningful ritual, that's up to us. But I was quite inspired by my very dear friend Lama Chanchub. I've been to his center a couple of times in Norway. It's really a lovely center, a lovely time, a lovely teacher. But one of the many things I really, really very much appreciated and respected in the way that the concessions are held there, as Lama Chanchub did this, is that at the beginning of each session, fairly short, some recitations, all of them very, very meaningful. If you're attending, they're very meaningful. But it was done first in Tibetan, and not many people are fluent in Tibetan, unless, you know, like me, you studied or you're native Tibetan. But it's there for kind of that flow of blessing. There's just something special about it, you know. Like the seven-line prayer of Padmasambhava. You can do it in English, but it's not quite the same, really, right? And so forth. And so in Lama Chanchub's center there in Norway, doing it once in Tibetan, there's the flow. That can easily be an empty ritual, but it doesn't have to be. It can be as meaningful as you make it, but you do it in Tibetan once, and then they do it again in English. So the second time, it doesn't have that feel of the Tibetan, but the meaning is crystal clear, right? I thought that was very nice, a nice balance of really revering the tradition, which goes back hundreds and hundreds of years in the Tibetan tradition alone. We're part of that continuum, part of that current. We revere the tradition. I revere the tradition. I have the beginning. As soon as I begin to appreciate it, revering that, and that's in Tibetan, right? At the same time here, even if English isn't our native language, everybody certainly has sufficient grasp of English that it really means something. And I'd like to just add a third element. So I was inspired by what's being done there. I just want to add a little third element. What we'll do for these short devotions is we'll go through once in Tibetan, once in English, and then once silent. So when it's silent, there's no ritual at all. So either doing it or you're not doing it at all. See, I spent hundreds of hours reciting liturgies and chanting all kinds of things in Tibetan, where the mouth can just keep on going where the mind has gone on a long vacation. You know, it very easily happens for Tibetans as well as Westerners and so on. So that winds up being an empty ritual. Outwardly, it all sounds good, and you have a nice. It all sounds really good, you know. If you thought that was good, that was, you know, it's as good as I get. But it's just going to base a lot of deep grunting noises, you know, and sometimes very melodic noises. But it's still melodic noises, and so we go from the outer, we go to the inner, and then the innermost is just no noise, no ritual, no nothing at all. You're either doing it right from your heart, or you're not doing it at all. So there's no fooling yourself. No fooling yourself at all, right? And so I just would add that little. So we do it once in Tibetan, once in English, then silently just doing it. And do it in your native language. If you want to use words, then it's Portuguese, Spanish, French, or what have you. So that's what we'll do. And I think that would be a nice thing for us to do together. It won't be long, because I have kind of like a busy mind, so I get bored because something goes on really long. Unless it's the longest long time and my busy mind is given vacation. That I like. So quick questions or comments? We're kind of wrapping up this week. We'll start with Hosa. Yeah. Microphone is coming. So for people listening by podcast, I will do my best, and I will ask people here, because podcast, they can listen, but they can't talk to us. And so on their behalf, when the question comes, please just remind me, because I can easily forget, to just give the paraphrase of the question so people listening by podcast can know what the question was. Hosa, what's on your mind?
My question pertains to exactly what you asked me, and I couldn't answer.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So now you're going to get back at me.
So let's get back at you.
Yep, no, that's my turn. Go ahead.
So last year you told us that if we practice this mindfulness of breathing technique that we just practiced yesterday, we could do it with our eyes closed.
Yes.
Because it's mindfulness of breathing.
Yeah.
So if we're doing 80% of the time awareness of awareness and 20% of the time...
It's not that. It's not 80% of the time. No, that's good. Now to clarify that. Yeah, not 80% of the time. Like, you know...
No, 80% of the attention.
Yeah. In the same time, it's a little bit of split attention.
Yes.
Like that. So, okay, now we're clear.
So, so the more relaxed you are, the more aware, and the more the awareness becomes, it becomes brighter. And the more relaxed you are, it's like... You fall asleep, right?
That's when you're losing clarity.
No, but you don't lose clarity.
Oh, you're relaxing as if you were falling asleep,
yes.
But without... Yes, okay,
yes,
still on the same page. Still on the same page.
Mm-hmm. And then if you go from that to awareness of awareness, because you're very relaxed, and so it's easier,
yeah.
But your eyes are closed.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a problem?
No.
Can you
phrase
that out?
Oh, thank you. No, but you had it. Oh, even though it's amplified, they're still not getting it because it's not my microphone. Okie dokie. So the simple question was, in this practice, if you're making the segue from mindfulness of breathing, 80% of the awareness, just resting in awareness, 20% attending to the breath, and then you just kind of smoothly slip right over into simply awareness of awareness, and you started with your eyes closed. If you end with your eyes closed, is that a problem? Because the classic teachings on awareness of awareness say keep your eyes open. The answer is no, not a problem. I think it was His Holiness. I can't be absolutely certain of this, but I think it was Holiness Dalai Lama when he was giving some meditation guidance. He said, okay, start with the eyes open, you know, at least somewhat open. We'll get back to that later, but somewhat open. But then over the course of the session, I mean, you could be starting out in awareness of awareness or whatever, but over the course of the session, as you're really just going deeper into the practice, and hopefully without losing clarity, as that happens, should your eyes just gently kind of close by themselves? Because you're really not paying attention to the eyes much, you're really focusing on your meditation. If the eyes just naturally close of themselves, then you say, oh, just relax, let it be. Big deal. No. When you go deeper, when you go especially into Mahamudra and Dzogchen, and then actually to a little peek ahead into the direct crossing over, the Tutgel, the culminating phase of Dzogchen practice, then eyes open quite clearly, explicitly, definitely open. And there are deep reasons for that. So in a way, in so many ways, these ground practices are preparing us for the later ones. And so, again, when I teach, you know, like settling the mind, I say eyes open. A lot of people say, I've never done that before. It's hard. My eyes getting dry. Can I blink? Why do I have to do that? Do I really have to? You know, all these kind of questions come up, quite understandably, because they're not accustomed to it. So it's good to get accustomed to it from the beginning, and I'll just give one practical reason right now. This is for people on listening by podcast, as well as those here. And it was Gelug Rinpoche, one from Gelugpa Lama. He pointed this one out. I heard it indirectly through the grapevine from him. He was asked the same question, because he's taught Mahamudra too. And so the question, and he said, well, here's one reason. It's the most practical one. I've given, I think, in the past two or three reasons, but this is the most practical one. Very relevant for all of us here, right? That whole theme of continuity. And he said, okay, well, here's a question, and that is throughout most of the day, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, throughout most of the daytime, are your eyes open or closed? And for most everybody, the answer is open. You know? I said, well, if you habituate yourself so that you can meditate only with your eyes closed, guess what? You won't be meditating for most of the day. And if meditation means just focusing on your breath or just focusing on Buddha image, well then so what? You have to attend to this and that and that and that and that. But that's a very, very tiny notion of meditation, just a technique. The really juice here of what we'll be doing throughout is these practices, you know, maybe with the exception of, you know, full-blown state regeneration practice with the visualization and so forth, even that you can carry into daily life. But certainly mindfulness of breathing, settling the mind, awareness of awareness, going to Mahamudra, can you do this when you're out and about? Absolutely, yes. Sure, this is kind of intended to saturate, like oil going to paper, saturating all the fibers of the paper. So the practice that we're focusing on here, these are definitely to be cultivated on the cushion and then brought out into the rest of the life. But if the rest of the life your eyes are open and you've only cultivated meditation with your eyes closed, then that's going to be tough. Because soon your eyes are open, I'm not meditating, I'm finished. I was doing that for a while when I was going like that. And I'm finished. So very practical. Learn how to do this with the eyes open. And then you develop that skill, and then when you're talking, you're eating, you're walking, sitting down, and so forth, you can continue to maintain your practice. So my favorite, I just mentioned this one of you in an interview today, but my favorite utterly quintessential, just that summary of Dharma practice in two phrases is from the great Dhomdumba, previous incarnation of his Honen Dalai Lama, principal disciple of the great Atisha. And I just give that punchline that he gives at the end of one of my favorite stories in Tibetan Buddhism. When he's giving someone quintessential advice, when he said, what does it mean to practice Dharma? This is so resonant with what we just read from Dzogchen Lingpa. He said, what does it mean to practice Dharma? I won't give the whole story, many of you have heard it, but just remember the punchline. When he said, okay, here it is, you ready? Give up all attachment to this life and let your mind become Dharma. Two phrases. That's it. Attachment to this life doesn't mean you don't want to live anymore. It means give up all attachment to mundane concerns. All of them. And then, releasing all that, all such attachment, then don't practice Dharma, put it down. Practice, put it down like a cup of tea. Let your mind become Dharma. With your eyes open. Sometimes with your eyes closed. Okay? Very good. All right, it's 6 o'clock. So we have tomorrow to practice. Monday morning, we'll start the morning with, it's starting, during our session here collectively with a short devotional practice, and we'll continue on. So good. So glad to be with you all. Glad to be vicariously, everyone listening to my podcast. And so it'll be quiet time tomorrow on the podcast, time just to practice for everybody. Good. Good night. See you tomorrow, Monday morning.